Radio Derb at your service once again, gentle listeners, and this is your host, John Derbyshire, with all the news of the hour. I apologise for a slight production glitch last Friday that had me sounding like Alvin the Chipmunk for a while. The parties responsible for that glitch have been reassigned to menial duties here at Buckley Towers. Cleaning out the head, peeling grapes for Jonah, proofreading George Gilder's next book review, chores like that. Any further mishaps of that sort will have them crawling through the air conditioning ducts looking for Catherine's pet tarantula that escaped from his box last week and hasn't been seen since. We run a tight ship here at NRO, let me tell you. OK, on with the motley. The Houston Rodeo is the biggest in the world. Its full name is Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo. It's held once a year. It goes on for 20 days, and it looks like a lot of fun. Main features: bull riding, pig racing, a calf scramble, concerts, a parade, and the World Championship Barbecue Contest. Attendance at the Rodeo this year was 1.8 million, which is pretty impressive. Now, you know that in today's America, you're not allowed to have that much fun without the diversity police coming and checking up on your compliance. Yep, here they come. A collection of Hispanic lobbying outfits headed by LULAC. That's the League of United Latin American Citizens with Nothing Better to Do. LULAC, whinging and whining that the Rodeo is insufficiently inclusive. I'm going to give you the grisly details here, but they're pretty shocking, so you might want to have a jar of smelling salts at hand to revive yourself after hearing this. Are you ready? The Rodeo's 16-member executive committee has no women or minorities. Oh my God. What are we in here, the Dark Ages? More. Of the 17 committees that control different aspects of the Rodeo, 14 are headed by Anglo men. How racist is that? There's worse to come. Of the 324 voting members of the Rodeo board, only 34 are women. Racism and sexism. And still worse. This year, the Rodeo decided not to include Tijano groups at the Rodeo concerts. Tijano is apparently some kind of Hispanic music. The grounds for not including Tijano music were, according to the Rodeo, that nobody likes it. Which seems fair enough to me. Are you still conscious? I've got even worse for you yet. Listen to this. Houston Rodeo has a big scholarship program to help young people get through college. But, and I can hardly bear to tell you this, so if my voice starts cracking a little, just please excuse me. This scholarship program is only open to U.S. citizens. Well, obviously this is a case for the federal government. So, the LULAC people went running off to Washington, D.C. to see if they could get Janet Reno and her flamethrowers down to Houston to teach this Rodeo a lesson in inclusiveness. Unfortunately, they were an administration too late. Janet Reno's running an alligator wrestling school in the Okefenokee Swamp. The Justice Department did offer to mediate the dispute, but Houston Rodeo were having none of it. Quote from Leroy Schaefer, the Rodeo's chief operating officer. Quote, "At this point, we see no need to have a Justice Department mediator involved in this. We've heard the minority group's issues. We think they are all pointless." End quote. Mr. Schaefer, I like the cut of your jib. Now, unless the Justice Department gets those flamethrowers out, the diversity nuisances are all out of options. Well, not quite. According to the Houston Chronicle, they're urging Hispanics to boycott the rodeo. Fair enough. Here's where Radio Derb swings into action. I'm going to organise an anti-boycott. That is, I'm going to encourage Radio Derb listeners to get on down to Houston for next year's rodeo and see if we can push attendance over the 2 million mark. I'll be there myself if I possibly can. I've never been to a rodeo. Perhaps I'll even have a try at the calf scrambling. Is that something like arm wrestling, but you use your calf instead, or what? The award for Best Actor at the Cannes Film Festival has gone to Benicio del Toro for his portrayal of Che Guevara in Steven Soderbergh's worshipful 4.5-hour epic about the famous revolutionary. For the word revolutionary there, you can read psychopathic fanatic. Che Guevara is the guy who wrote in his diary, quote, "To send men to the firing squad, judicial proof is unnecessary. These procedures are an archaic bourgeois detail. This is a revolution. And a revolutionary must become a cold killing machine motivated by pure hate." End quote. Well, Che lived up to that, or rather down to it, not just shipping class enemies off to the firing squads, but supervising executions himself, especially liking to parade victims past the blood-spattered wall against which they were to be shot, and often administering the coup de grace, that's the bullet to the back of the head, himself. So here's this movie actor, Benicio del Toro, a Puerto Rican-born US citizen, portraying this repulsive murderer in Steven Soderbergh's movie. How does he feel about playing Che? Well, listen. Here's what del Toro said on receiving his award at Cannes. Quote, "I'd like to dedicate this to the man himself, Che Guevara. I wouldn't be here without Che Guevara, and through all the awards the movie gets, you'll have to pay your respects to the man." End quote. Let's hope that some moviegoers will instead pay their respects to all the people who would be here if they hadn't been murdered by Guevara, and indeed also to those who drowned or were shot while attempting to escape the totalitarian hellhole that Cuba became under the regime of Castro, Guevara, and their fellow assassins. A very good way to pay these latter respects would be to stay away from Steven Soderbergh's disgraceful movie, and from his future movies too. Barack Obama, who I'm willing to bet has a Che Guevara t-shirt in his closet somewhere, Barack Obama gave a commencement speech at Wesleyan University last weekend. I logged the speech at 3,300 words. The word service occurred 17 times, which is better than one per paragraph on average formatting. What does Obama mean by service, though? Like service in the armed services? Oh dear, my goodness, no. He spoke, for example, of the purpose that service gave my own life. I guess he means all that community organizing he was doing back in the 80s. Then he speaks of the Peace Corps volunteers and the civil rights freedom riders of the 1960s. And then, quote, "There's no community service requirement in the real world. No one forcing you to care," end quote. Well, I'm sure that will soon change under an Obama presidency. And then there's the thrill that comes when people, quote, force an unresponsive leader to provide services to their community, end quote. It seems that the word service in Obama's mind doesn't wander very far from the word community, which of course means black people. And then there's a whole lot of stuff about Ted Kennedy's service, presumably referring to Kennedy's 45 years in the US Senate. So we're getting the picture here. Service has nothing to do with the private sector economy, and nothing whatever to do with the military. It's all about community action and political agitation and getting into Congress and staying there for 4 or 5 decades. Well, nothing particularly wrong with any of those things, but that's it. This is just a more inflated version of Mrs. Obama's exhortation to the nation's youth back in February, as reported by our own Byron York. Quote, "Don't go into corporate America. Work for the community." This is the Obama's entire outlook. Productive, profit-seeking corporations are instruments of Satan. No good-hearted person should go to work for them. But then, Mr. and Mrs. Obama, who will pay the bills? Productive, profit-seeking corporations are the bones and muscles of our economy and the foundation of our country's strength. Their revenues make everything else possible, including community service. Do the Obamas understand this? On the evidence of their speeches so far, they do not. NASA's Phoenix spacecraft landed safely near the North Pole of Mars. It will now start digging down through the Martian surface to look for ice. Will it find traces of life, past or present? Oxford University philosopher Nick Bostrom says we should hope it doesn't. He has an article in the current MIT Technology Review arguing his case. I can't summarize it properly in a couple of hundred words, and I urge you to read it for yourself. It's on the internet. In a nutshell, Bostrom starts from one of the great scientific mysteries of our age, the so-called Great Silence. According to the best theories we have about how life originates and develops, advanced civilizations should be plentiful in the universe. So how come there's no trace of them? No visits, no structured signals? After 50 years of scanning the heavens, we've detected absolutely nothing. Well, says Bostrom, take the present state of our civilization as a point on a timeline. With the origin of life as a distant point in the far past, and a civilization capable of interstellar travel or communication at a point in the future. Then there's obviously some huge stumbling block that prevents life from getting to that future point. And that stumbling block is either behind us or ahead of us. If it's behind us, it may be way back behind. It may be that the origin of life on a planet is a fantastically rare occurrence. If it's ahead of us, it can't be far ahead. We can already broadcast signals into space. So now, if there is life on Mars, or if there ever was, that means that the origin of life is not fantastically improbable. Heck, it happened on 2 adjacent planets in 1 solar system. That reduces the probability that the stumbling block is in the past, and it correspondingly increases the likelihood that it's in our future, our near future. It would indicate, in fact, that our species may be on the edge of extinction. If the origin and development of life is a common thing, lots of species all over the universe got to where we are. But none of them got much further. Uh-oh. Let's hope there is no sign of life on Mars. yet another follow-up on the Texas polygamy case. I started out 2 weeks ago with the observation that while I have no problem with prosecuting welfare fraud or statutory rape or violations of state marriage laws, I could not for the life of me see where there was any justice or humanity in taking 460 kids, 130 of them less than 5 years old, away from the only homes, parents, and playmates they had ever known. That is not right. Well, last week I reported that the Texas Third Appeal Court agreed with me. They ruled that the Texas officials who had kidnapped the children and scattered them to various kinds of care and foster homes had failed to demonstrate that the kids were in any danger, as required by Texas law. Now, here is more good news. The Texas Supreme Court has affirmed the appeals court decision. Quote, "We are not inclined to disturb the Court of Appeals decision. On the record before us, removal of the children was not warranted." End quote. This FLDS cult looks like a pretty unsavory business, but that's no reason to go wrecking the lives of hundreds of children. There has to be a better way to deal with whatever illegalities are being committed. Perhaps it's worth pointing out, too, as many readers have emailed in to remind me, that 12 and 13-year-old girls are being impregnated by adult men every day of the week in the ghettos of America's inner cities. And nobody's snatching those kids away from their mothers. Why not? What's the difference? Well, see if you can figure it out. Sharon Stone, the movie actress, got herself into a spot of bother the other day when being interviewed by a Hong Kong movie crew. Here's what she said. Quote, "I'm not happy about the way the Chinese are treating the Tibetans, because I don't think anyone should be unkind to anyone else. And then all this earthquake and all this stuff happened, and I thought, is that karma?" End quote. Naturally, this caused shock and horror after it was broadcast all over China. Now, Chinese movie chains are boycotting Sharon's movies, and a big cosmetic firm that she models for, which sells a lot of stuff in China, has dropped her. I'm never quite sure where to go with this Tibet stuff. On the one hand, it's embarrassing to find yourself on the same side of any issue as the Hollywood airhead set. I mean, it's embarrassing. I don't want to keep company with these people. On the other hand, I've had some slight acquaintance of my own with the Tibet cause for nearly 25 years, and it's a good cause, one that I strongly sympathise with. Tibetans are not Chinese. They don't speak Chinese, they don't dress Chinese or eat Chinese or worship Chinese. They've run their own affairs for most of their history, and they were running them pretty well and minding their own business when Mao Zedong marched his armies into their country in 1950. That was an act of naked imperialism by Mao. What followed was far worse, with Tibetans massacred and starved by the Chinese communists, and their historic buildings wrecked, their national treasures carted off to China, their environments despoiled and polluted, and hundreds of thousands of Tibetans were just murdered by the Chinese communists. It's a dreadful story, very well documented, and a great blot on modern Chinese civilization. Tragically, very few Chinese people know the truth about Tibet. The Maoists just tell them, oh, it's always been a part of China. There are just a few agitators there, in the pay of China's foreign enemies, that's all. The disturbances this last March were actually represented to the Chinese people by the Communist Party propaganda apparatus as the victimization of innocent Chinese people by Tibetan hooligans. It's bad enough to have your country stolen from you. To then be portrayed as an aggressor is a double insult. Well, I'm certainly not going to go along with Airhead Sharon on the karma stuff, which is all nonsense. The Chinese earthquake is a ghastly tragedy all of its own, but that's all that can be said. The Chinese communists did do great wickedness in Tibet, and the Chinese people, by allowing themselves to believe the communists' imperialist propaganda lies, share some collective complicity in that horrible crime. That's nothing to do with earthquakes, but it's true anyway, even though dim-witted Hollywood airheads are the main people talking about it. Okay, here's our traditional miscellany of short items to see us out. Item, there's a slight problem up there on the International Space Station. The toilet's backed up. Don't you hate it when that happens? I have one of those roto-rooter things for when we have a major bathroom malfunction, chez d'oeuvre, but I guess they forgot to ship one with the space station. You think it's tough to get a plumber at weekends? Try getting one when you're 200 miles up and travelling at 17,000 miles an hour. Now, call me nosy, but there's a thing I've been wondering about the International Space Station since this story first broke. Seeing that the thing is international, what style of toilet do they have? Do they have the sit-down kind, or the kind where you crouch over a hole? I mean, you know, some countries prefer the one and some the other. I was hoping that the news pictures might tell me, but so far none of them has. Well, anyway, you guys up there, as my dad used to tell us kids on long car trips, just hold it for a while. I'm sure they'll have a relief ship up there in a week or two. And relief is definitely the right word here. Item, the town of Mattawa, 150 miles east of Seattle in Washington State, is surrounded by miles of fruit orchards and vineyards, it says here. Well, that's nice. That probably accounts for Mattawa having grown from 300 to well over 3,000 inhabitants in the last 20 years. And guess what? 90% of the town's population now speaks Spanish. 80% of the 90% speak English, quote, less than well, according to the latest census figures, which I think you can take to mean not at all. Of the 10% of Mattawans who speak English, very few know any Spanish, and that would include the city government and the police department. Well, now a legal aid group has filed a complaint under the Civil Rights Act, and the feds have stepped in. The Justice Department has ordered the town to go bilingual in its dealings with townspeople, employing at least one bilingual person at all times, and publishing all its printed materials in Spanish as well as English. It would, of course, be shamefully racist to expect people living in our country to speak our language. Better to dump the cost of federal immigration non-enforcement on the taxpayers of tiny, poor country towns. Item, I have no clue what to make of this flap over Scott McClellan's book. I don't know the guy, and I don't know what went on in the White House any better than the average citizen does. It is, though, another illustration of the fact that this administration is falling apart even sooner and more comprehensively than happens to most administrations in the final few months of a second presidential term. And the main reason for that is the Iraq War, a horrible blunder that will hang round the neck of George W. Bush and his administration, and the memory and reputation of them, forever. What McClellan's motives are, and whether he's correct on the details, I don't know. I do know, though, that if some insults from a disaffected staffer are the worst punishment that Bush and Cheney and company take for the Iraq fiasco, they will have got off very lightly. Item: Al-Qaeda's calling on jihadists to use NBC against targets in the West. No, that's not NBC, the TV news network. Not that I'd be terrifically surprised if Al-Qaeda deployed them, but that's not what I'm talking about. NBC is NATO jargon for nuclear, biological and chemical weapons. It's probably hollow talk by a bunch of guys in caves up there in the Hindu Kush. And I'm not going to lose any sleep over it myself. Still, 10 or 20 years from now, who knows what these lunatics might be capable of? The solution is pretty simple. Just don't let people from Muslim countries enter the USA. And politely ask those who are here to leave. It's our country. We can let in who we like. And we can send home any foreigners that we don't trust. Why don't we have the will to do this? If, heaven forbid, if the jihadi dream comes true, then we'll do it fast enough. But why wait? Well, because we're damn fools, that's why, whose brains have been rotted by political correctness. Folly has its price, and one day, I'm afraid that we, that's you and me and your children and my children, will pay that price. Item: nice little story here in Condé Nast Portfolio. They sent a reporter to the Kurdish region of North Iraq, and he found a nice, bustling little mini-nation. Quote: "The Kurdistan region is Paul Wolfowitz's wet dream. Maybe not a beacon of democracy, but certainly a red-hot ember. Peaceful, orderly, secular, democratic, wildly capitalist, and sentimentally pro-American. Afloat on an ocean of oil." End quote. I doubt things are quite that rosy. This little Kurdish state has a lot of hungry and angry and crazy neighbours. Still, it all confirms the great trend of our times, which is the rise of states based on common ethnicity and the breakup or decline of nations that have big blocks of different kinds of people in them, like the old Iraq. Czechoslovakia, Cyprus, Yugoslavia, the USSR. Where are the multi-ethnic states that I remember? I'd say that Iraq is near the head of the list for the next country to break up, along with Belgium and Canada, maybe Bolivia, maybe Nigeria, perhaps Iran, which after all is only half Persian. Can the really big ones be far behind? India? The USA? I won't think about that today. I'll think about that tomorrow. Meanwhile, sell multiculturalism, buy ethno-nationalism. What a depressing note to end on. I'm sorry, I can't come up with anything brighter. The impending demise of Mrs. Clinton's electoral prospects might have cheered me up in other circumstances, but the prospect of an Obama candidacy turns even that into wormwood and gall. Obama and McCain. Oh boy, I need a drink. Cheers.